You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of October 18th, 2023, and we're all bundled up in our cocoons.
I'm George Alpore.
My name is Scott Juster.
And this is a series been a humanist conversation about them old video games. We've been playing some. We're going to talk a little bit about some games that we've chatted about briefly thus far, as well as a couple of newer ones that we've played, finished, less half finished. Two of the big ones, I will segue us in a little bit.
Okay.
With something that I enjoy about both, because we're talking a little bit about Chance of Sinnar, which is what I'll talk about. You'll talk a little bit about Cocoon. I played a little bit of Cocoon today, though. But both games do something that I really enjoy in video games, which is kind of like in media res, where when you start to play, they just don't explain anything.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like you're just, you were just in the world. Push buttons, see what they do, right? Yep. Like there, you do not, in neither game, do you get this, you know, bespoke, discrete tutorial segment where it's like, this is how you fucking accomplish everything, right? And I really like that. It feels so respectful and mature, you know? Mm-hmm. And after playing so many game tutorials, I kind of love the idea of like, we'll just teach you as you go, you know? Yeah. And it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different than like the in media res of, say, an Uncharted, right? We're like, oh my God, you're Nathan Drake and you're in a fucking train now. Like,
record scratch. I bet you're wondering how I got here.
Yeah, like there's, and it's more, almost more of like a, look, the world is what it is, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to speak to you in the language of the world, right? And the gameplay is a part of that world as well. And I think to me, that feels just immediately like resonant. It just works for me right off the bat because it feels so true to the environment and your experience, you know. Lies of P doesn't start that way. Like, you start on a train, some fucking, you know, Geppetto or whatever's like, oh, Pinocchio, you gotta go do this thing for me. And, you know, there's, despite being immersed in the world very, very quickly, I truly, to be truly in it right off the bat, I think that's a really cool experience.
There's a whole, I would be interested in reading like a long form analysis of the history of tutorialization in video games, both explicit and implicit tutorialization, because it's been such a, there's so many different ways of doing it, you know. It's, there's the, there's kind of the Super Mario Brothers way where it's like the first thing you see is a Goomba coming from right to left and you're going from left to right and it just kind of teaches you how the game works. And
and there's like everything. A safe pit or you have to jump over.
A pit with no consequences, and it's like, man, that's smart. And but then there's like, I feel like in the earlier mid 2000s, there was the like Gears of War kind of, hey, Marcus, let's go to the training grounds. You know, they tried to like root it in the narrative, you know, which is a different way of doing it. Like,
there are like games where you're literally like in a combat simulator.
Yes. What else did that from that era? Modern Warfare did that, like the training ground or whatever, all that stuff. There's just, I don't know, the side, total tangent, but like there's, it's such a, it's, there's so many different ways to approach it. Both of those games take the minimalist approach.
I think the minimalist approach is the least patronizing. Like, I just feel talked down to when it's, hey, we need to put you through a combat simulator or something.
Hey, Chief, time to shake off the rust. You've been in crisis. You've been in stasis for 10 years. Do you know how to jump? It's like,
it's worse than that. It's like, hey, look up. Okay, great. Like, it's just, it's such a bizarre thing to do when you are meant to be embodying someone that is in this world, right? Like, you don't wake up and learn to walk again every day, you know? Like, that's just not a thing that you do. So it feels weird to me to have that in video games. Anyway, I think that's cool. Why don't we use that as a segue? Do you want to talk about Cocoon first? Do you want to talk about Chance? How do you want to start?
Maybe talk about Chance of Sinnar first, and then we'll go into Cocoon.
Okay. Chance of Sinnar is Duolingo, the video game.
So something that I'll download with good intent and never touch again?
I hope not. I hope you see it through. So Chains of Sennaar is a super interesting game. And Sennaar is S-E-N-N-A-A-R. So two N's, two A's.
And chants as in like chanting a song or a... or
caress.
A,
yeah. Correct. Yeah, Chains of Sennaar. So when I say Duolingo, this is literally a game that is about learning languages. You start off in the game and as described in sort of in media res, mechanically speaking, someone comes up to you and they say something to you and it's just in runes and you have no idea what they're going to say. Yeah. And eventually you will learn that language. You'll learn that language in a soft sense, right? Each language in the game, and there are, I think, five, mm-hmm. really more so like four, because the fifth one is sort of a gimme. It's given to you very, very mm-hmm. easily. But the languages are sets of runes that you encounter throughout the world, or glyphs. And these are everywhere, right? They're signage. People will talk to you and the glyphs will appear in speech and text. And there's no translation. You have to select which glyph you want to sort of type in what you think the word is. Mm-hmm. So to give you a really basic example, and there, I'm going to talk about a few sort of mechanical spoilers a little bit, because I think this game is genuinely best experienced completely blind.
Yeah.
But one of the first things that you encounter is a lever next to a closed door, right? Mm. And the lever is in the up position, and there's a little glyph right next to it, right? And then there's another glyph in the down position, and when you pull it down, the door opens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it's reasonable and correct to assume whatever that glyph is at the top must mean open, mm-hmm. and whatever the glyph is at the bottom must mean closed. And in fact, there's two glyphs on each side. So there's a glyph and then another one that is the same. And then at the bottom, a different glyph and then that same glyph.
Mm-hmm.
So you can piece that together and say, okay, these two glyphs up here mean open door. And this right. glyph down here means closed door, right?
Because there's a continuity of like, it's the same glyph on the top and bottom, but a different first glyph. So it's like there's a continuity between a word in there.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And you will open your notebook and you'll have each glyph and you literally type in, I think this means open. I think this means closed, right? Eventually, when you encounter enough words, you get a little notebook that opens up on the side that will have you validate your words by showing you like a door that's open, a door that's closed, a few other words that you've encountered. You plug them in, and if you got all of them right within that set, maybe it's five or six words, then it locks it in and says, yes, that is what that word means.
Okay.
Or it'll, you know, almost sort of shortcut you giving it serious thought and change it to the correct word. So, you know, you might put, for example, God, but the actual word is like, I don't know, leader or something, right? Mm. Not quite the same word, but it's in the ballpark. Something that you could have reasonably thought out if this were a real world, right?
And that's something that is kind of hard-coded in. Like there's a certain set of words that the game will determine is close enough and then give you that kind of confirmation.
It actually has nothing to do with the words that you type. It's just whether or not you put the right glyph to the right corresponding visual.
Oh, got it. So if there's a visual, like I've seen some screenshots where it's like there's a visual of like a lock or something, then if you've put that glyph next to the picture, it'll say, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, even if the word that you have in there was a placeholder like dog or poop or something like that, it doesn't matter, right?
Right.
The sense is that you are understanding that, you know, this image corresponds to this glyph. Now, in that sense, this game is a little bit easy, right? Like this isn't super challenging. It does validate the words that you are crafting,
right?
And I know that there are games out there that are based upon similar concepts of language. I think there's one that's like Heavenly something that does not validate the words, and so you have to go through the game and experience that story in a true language learning sense. And right. I think that's its own kind of experience. Chains of Sennaar is a puzzle game, but that language is this really like thick layer on top of it. So most of the game you are just trying to work out what do these words mean, but there's also other elements of you sort of moving things around the environment, bringing objects to certain people. Someone might ask you for something, but they're asking you in a language that you don't understand.
Right.
And so when you see those words and you start to figure out, okay, this word means want, and this word means banana, this dude wants a banana. Okay, where can I go get a banana, right? Like the things like that. I'm going to give you a couple more examples, though, because I want to sort of impress upon you how cool I think the experience of playing Chains of Sennaar is as you could progress, because the story takes place in what is essentially the Tower of Babel, right? Where everyone has forgotten the languages that they speak to each other. And there's a cultural hierarchy. So when you first enter the tower, there's like devotees, right? Or these, you know, individual people that are at the base of the tower. And there's a warrior class that's preventing you from moving on. Now, eventually you will get through the beginning section and you'll enter the warrior class. And the warrior class has their own language. So you're also learning the warrior class language when you get to that next step. And then there's, I forget what the other one, it's almost like there's a one higher than the warriors that's basically like the artists. And then there's a level above them that are like the scientists and scholars. And each of them have their own language. But what's so cool is that each of their languages are structured differently as well. They look different. They're structured differently. And even within the sentence structure, they'll move things around. So I'm just going to give you a few more examples just to like illustrate it, right? Yeah. So in the beginning level, you find a sign that points two different directions, like a travel sign, right? Like if you want to go to the garden this way and the cemetery this way, which is literally where they're pointing, right? You'll notice that each of them in the glyph have a sort of horizontal and vertical line enclosing another glyph, right? And you can put two and two together, and what's kind of fun, right, is to go, okay, well, what is common between these two is that they're locations. So maybe the horizontal and vertical bar that surrounds this glyph indicates that this is a place. Right.
Yeah.
So the garden, then maybe what this is saying is that the word is plant and then the square around it indicates place. So the word for garden in this language is basically plant, place. And the same is true for the cemetery. Right. It's the symbol for death and then the place around that. So at first glance, it looks like they're each their own individual glyphs, but they're not. Like, there are signifiers to indicate the type of word and like structure,
the that structure of the phrase is inside of one glyph,
which is, it's such like a cool experience to like, put those things together and start seeing, well, this symbol looks like this symbol. I wonder if sort of etymologically there's a connection between these two, and oftentimes there is. And as you go along, like, the warrior class is different, and you have different words for even some of the ones that you used, right? They don't call devotees. They call them something else, right? They call them like people or humans or, you know, or the feeble-minded or something, and so on and so forth. And each structure is different. Sometimes the sentence structure, and eventually you're actually, you have to translate two of them speaking to one another, and their sentence structure changes. So in the beginning place, it's much more like ours, right? Like, I want dog could be something that you say, but at a, in the higher level up area, the sentence structure might instead be dog want I you, right? Which is their way of saying, I want you to bring me a dog. Right. So like those, the structure itself adjusts as you go. And eventually you start working with numbers as well. Like, the scientists, one of the major puzzles in that area is figuring out how they count. Like, what is the symbols that for them making numbers? And you learn eventually that like different positions along a single glyph reflect which place in the number value you have, such that you can create something that says like 10,056 with a single glyph, right?
Right.
It's such a cool idea. And whoever made this was took the language and the way that people speak it and construct it super seriously. And all of this is completely emergent, you know, emergently figured out as you play. The idea of like going into the warrior class or the scientist class, and there's a bunch of signs and it's all fucking gibberish, and people are talking to you and you have no idea what they're saying.
Yeah.
It feels impossible. It feels like such a crazy struggle to overcome. But within 30 minutes, an hour, like, you will learn all of these words. You know what everyone is saying.
Yeah.
And they'll translate it for you once you've locked in the glyphs. And it feels, in a very real way, to scratch that itch that language learning scratches, right? Like, I don't know. I haven't studied languages in a long time, but it's something that I both find extremely frustrating because it's super challenging. But on the other hand, really rewarding when you realize, like, I know some of these words, right? When it becomes second nature to you.
Right.
And to have it walk through that, it's such a cool, unique experience. And I really, really enjoy the game overall. It's also got kind of like a cool little story that's going on with the Tower of Babel and the way that these people interact with one another and forging connections. I'm not going to say it's perfect. It's ultimately like secondary to the core puzzle mechanics. But if you want to play like a simple like indie game this year, I think Chances of Nara is awesome. And it might actually be on like my top game list so far.
The I wonder, I don't know any, I don't know any languages not descended from the Latin alphabet.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wonder if it is at all similar to languages that have more symbolic characters in them.
Yeah, like Japanese or or Chinese. Yeah. I took one semester of Chinese and it was so fucking hard. I wish it were as easy as Chance of Sinar, where I could just like validate it and then instantly know it. But yeah, I think that's totally accurate. And the scripts are beautiful too. Some of them look almost like Arabic, right? Like really heavily stylized. Much more challenging to read as you progress as well, but you start to figure it out and see comparisons between the two.
The game is striking too, just visually.
It reminds me a lot of the art of Luka Regic, who's this like independent RPG designer and creator. Really sort of minimalistic, but like evocative color schemes.
Yeah.
With simple but bold lines. I like it quite a bit.
Yeah. That's cool. I hope I get a chance to devote some time to it because it's a unique and cool looking game too.
Yes. Yes, for sure. Okay, that's Chance of Sinar. Talk to me about Cocoon.
Okay, Cocoon. I don't know how to pronounce his name. It might be Jeppe or Jeppe? Jeppe Carlson?
Uh-huh.
He was the designer, or perhaps one of the designers, on Limbo and Inside.
That's right, yes.
And then at some point left Play Dead, and this is this was one of the games, I guess this is probably the first game that he put out since departing. And I didn't realize that until I started playing this game.
And you didn't love either of those games.
No, I actively didn't like Limbo. Like I to this day, I think that Limbo is I don't know. Like I have philosophical problems with Limbo's game design.
I've come around to your side. I think Inside is fine, but I agree. I think Limbo is hugely overrated.
I mean, and it's not like, I don't think Limbo is like a crappy game. I just have philosophical objections to how that game is designed. So much so that I didn't even play Inside, and so much so that I might have been biased against playing Cocoon had I known where the development heritage is from.
Yeah, yeah.
However, I'm very glad I didn't, because I think Cocoon fixes a lot of my objections with Limbo, weirdly enough.
Yeah. Yeah. So much, as I recall, with Limbo systems were punitive and for no reason, right? It's like you don't, there's no indication to teach. You just die there, and now you know, don't die there next time.
Exactly. There's no...
It's a memorization thing. It's not like an education or learning thing.
It's pure trial and error. Like, it's learning through trial and error, not necessarily... Trial and error is a legitimate way of handling a lot of the puzzles, but it shouldn't be the only one. But in Limbo, it's basically the only one. And so, but like Cocoon is quite different from that. And some of it, I think, is handled, they handled it cleverly from a narrative sense and just from a like structural, like what happens to you when you fail versus when you succeed. Like it's not as jarring because you're not having a spike driven through your skull like you are in Limbo. It's just like kind of kicks you up to the next level or like whatever. I'm getting ahead of myself, but I think Cocoon is actually a really good evolution of this type of design of this type of puzzle game. And this is a puzzle game basically at its core, similar to Chance of Sinar. And I think you mentioned this at the top. You literally, your character emerges from a cocoon, drops onto the ground, and then you're in it. You're just playing the game. Nothing. Yep. Like no buttons, no nothing. You know, like no explanation of what you're doing or why. You just start exploring the world and you figure out how you interact with the world and what certain items do in the world. And you're basically, this is a game about unlocking gates. You know, you have to get to the next path. How do I unlock this gate? How do I bridge this gap? How do I open this door? All of that stuff. And it's puzzles to get through them.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it's one button. It's move with the stick and press A.
it was funny because the kids were like, can you teach me how to play this game? And I was like, quite easy, children. Like,
you already know how to play.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's a one button game where whether you're interacting with a switch or picking up an item or whatever, it's just walking and pressing the A button. But they do so much with that very limited input, because it's all about just interactions of what happens when you do those actions.
Yeah.
I'm very much enjoying it. I'm very close to the end, I sense. But I won't give away everything that happens, but how far in did you play any of it?
I have, yeah. So I played against the first boss, and then I got to the second world. So I've been exploring sort of, I don't know, it seems like a sort of ocean-y place.
Yeah, it's like but a what swamp I've already, type of thing.
What I'm curious about, because what I've already realized is that I'm going to have to bring... So each world is essentially like a ball, and you can enter these balls and explore those levels.
Yeah.
But those levels in ball form exist outside at that higher level.
Yes.
But you can also bring them with you inside. So I'm curious to know, like, how much of like balls in balls and balls stuff is going on here? Like, is that like an added layer of puzzling out? Like, okay, I need to bring green ball into red ball to get purple ball. Like, is that a thing?
That becomes the game. That is the game. So like you're kind of at the place where the game really starts to open up. Yeah. And so and that's where I really started enjoying the game, because the like you said, every environment is encased in that sphere. And so you can take a sphere with an environment into another environment, and then you can carry around that nested environment to another place that you might need. And so it gets to the point where in order to get past an obstacle, you're like, oh, I actually need something from the desert environment, but how do I get there? It's like, oh, I can hide the desert environment inside of the world of the swamp environment, and then inception myself, kick myself back up to the top level, and then pick up the whole dang thing of a world within a world, move it to where I need it, and then jump back into it and be on the right side of that gate.
Yeah, that's so 3D chess, dude. Like, that feels so complicated to me. I don't know if I have it in me to, like, solve that degree of puzzling out. Because it's a cool idea. It's a really cool idea, right?
Yeah.
Let's make each of these levels literal objects.
Yeah.
And now how those literal objects interact with one another becomes the game, like the levels within the levels.
Yep.
That's such a cool idea. It's very meta, very neat.
I haven't really seen it before. I don't know if other games have approached it, you know?
The only thing it reminds me of, and I don't... I was literally talking to someone about this, and I don't remember the name. But there was the game where you could, like, enlarge objects in the small world to appear in the big world.
Oh,
you know what I'm talking about? There was, like, a huge key that you could make as a bridge.
Yes. It was... I think I had to stop playing that game because it was making me motion sick.
It made me motion sick as well. It's also not a great game, to be perfectly honest. Yeah.
I know exactly what game you're talking... Because they were like... Oh, was it called Maquette?
Maybe.
Maquette, something like that. Because there was little dioramas that you were moving the items around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like your world was a diorama within your world, so on and so forth, ad infinitum, right? Like, you can always interact in that way. That's like the closest thing I could think of, right? In terms of trying to sort of map out and then give you the tools to sort of cognitively think in this, like, larger frame, you know?
Yeah. But, I mean, I think the... So you have this, like, multi-layered puzzle where it's like there's a puzzle of how do I unlock this door, because when I step on this pressure plate, the gate opens, but when I leave the pressure plate, the gate closes, and I need to, like, figure out some way to keep that open. And, like, it, you know, there's only one way to solve every problem in this game, so it's that sort of puzzle game.
Okay,
but
cool.
The puzzles are designed in such a way that are very... I just find them kind of clever, because there really is only one solution to them, and so it has to be hard enough that it's a challenge, but it can't be so obscure that you can't brute force your way through it, because there's no brute forcing it in this game. And so it's a nice balancing act that they do, and it's always impressive to me when people are able to walk that line of this made me feel really smart, but there's only one solution. So how smart could I actually be, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's really cool. I'm glad to see it. It seems really cool and really, really fun. Annapurna published this, by the way, which again, like, this feels like an Annapurna game. So
yes, I like it a lot. And there are, to your point, there are some action elements in it, but even in those action elements,
like the boss fight. Yeah.
Yeah. There's it's still the same controls, you know, you're still moving and using the interact button, but you're put in a different context to, you know, the boss fights are basically fast paced puzzles where it's like, okay, like, you know, you've proven you can do this, but can you do it with under pressure or under a time limit? And, you know, here's how to go. And again, kind of similar to the Limbo thing, the boss fights are actually kind of punishing in that if you have to hit the boss 3 or 4 times, if you get hit, it kicks you back one level. So it's not like you're being crushed into like a slimy pulp like you are in Limbo, but you're just being kicked back up into the next world. And then when you go back down, you just go right back into the boss fight. So like there's just something narratively that is more palatable to me than having to like suspend my disbelief over a grisly death every single time. Yeah. And I've appreciated how they've done that. Although I will say it can be, there was a boss where the kids and I had to do it like 10 times before we got it right. And it's demoralizing to get to the last stage of the boss, take a bad shot, and then, oh crap, now we have to go all the way back in.
Yeah, know? I noticed that with the first boss that you cannot, it's not like you take multiple hits. There's no health tracker. You get hit once.
Right.
That's a fail state, and you get pushed out. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I will definitely finish it. I'm very close to the end, I can tell. And
you're going to hatch and become a beautiful butterfly.
I mean, that's the other thing. The kids are like trying to ask me like, well, what is this about? Why is there this big, what's that big thing? Why did that make a noise? And I'm like, kids, I know as much of this game of, I know as much as you do. Like there's literally no words in this game. We have to kind of use our imagination. So the world is very evocative. It makes a lot of sense that this is someone from Play Dead lineage because there's kind of that, I don't even know what sort of art style. It's kind of flat gothic style.
Yeah. I will say the world design is super cool because it is inventive creature design in a way that you just don't see very often. Like big, lumbering, weird, but also robotic things. Like at one point I was dragging things that looked like towers slash like ocean tubers that had sort of slug feet, you know? Yeah. Or there's the huge like, I don't know what you would call it, almost like a crate that is alive and has kind of crab legs or, you know, the way that some of the robots kind of spread themselves out. It's a really neat, like futuristic setting that they put a lot of thought into.
It's a weird, like organic, kind of mechanical, you know, sort of.
Yeah. Like the boss fight themselves being like crystal, but also there's like weird bees that are part of them. It's neat. It's really neat.
Yeah. So anyway, Cocoon, I unambiguously recommend it. It's a pretty neat game and just a cool realization of that game style that has won me over this time around.
Man, lots of games this year. Should we touch quickly on any others?
Yeah, give me a check in on Lies of P because it's one of those that I haven't touched yet, but I know you started it and I'm interested in how it's going.
I can tell you now I've upgraded my P organ. Yes, it's called a P organ. I'm really liking it. I think this is solid Bloodborne mimicry at its finest. There's a couple of really cool things that I like a lot about the weapon upgrade system. In classic Dark Souls fashion, it is convoluted and confusing. I strongly recommend if you're being frustrated in the game with like, I'm not doing any damage or something, Google it because you're probably doing something wrong, right? Mm. One of the cool things that I like about it is whenever you find a weapon, the weapon has two parts, the blade or the head of the weapon and the hilt, and you can separate them. And the hilt defines the damage type, or rather the damage scaling, like if it scales to motivity, or which is this game's version of strength or dex. And then the blade is the damage type and some of the movesets, and you can swap them. And so you can customize a weapon that you might like to do particular kinds of damage that works for your build. So attaching like the police baton attachment to this big hammer makes like a slightly different weapon with a slightly different ability that I think works really, really well. And there's a lot of sort of kind of cool combat you can work around that, right? Like you also have that cool arm that you can use in the game, and you can swap that out, change its powers. The upgrading system around P-Organ is somewhat interesting in that you have to sort of choose two customization options to unlock another customization option, if that makes sense. So you're kind of like nesting your upgrades to give you these like passive bonuses as you play. But I think the world is really cool. It's well designed. It's not nearly as top tier as Bloodborne. You can feel it in the level design. It's not as complex. There's not as many like variable paths that you can take. So sometimes it can feel a little bit railroady, a little bit samey in its art design. But for the most part, it's cool. And the story is compelling, remarkably. I never thought I would say this, but like for a Pinocchio game, it's actually kind of interesting. The NPCs are great. Like the dialogue is good. The music is great. I enjoy exploring the worlds. And I mean, part of it too is I feel so comfortable in this space, right? It, playing a game like Bloodborne, like Dark Souls, it's just, I have committed so much of my life, my adult life, to playing these games, right? And so much time and energy into playing them. And I speak their language now, like in the Chance of Sennar style, right? And so when you enter a space and I see a new enemy and I'm sort of, I target lock on it and I'm walking around it and I'm watching it move and it attacks me and I take the hit and then it attacks me again and I dodge and it attacks me again and I block, a perfect parry, right? Like that back and forth dialogue between me and the game feels so comforting and it's capturing that. And so of course I'm going to love it. Of course I'm going to love it. You know, it's doing what I want out of these Souls-likes.
It's kind of cool that, it's kind of cool that one of these games has seemingly broken through. Like, I feel like there's a lot of these games now. And it seems like if you would have told me that a dark retelling of the Pinocchio fairy tale was going to be the Souls-like that really broke through, I would have not believed you. And so it's a funny, for whatever reason. I mean, it just sounds like it's systemically very sound. You know, it's kind of broken through.
Yeah. And there's some things that aren't great, right? Like the parry windows are still too tight and there's some readability issues that I think the Souls games don't have to that same degree for the most part. But yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about was I played Remnant earlier this year, Remnant 2 from the Ashes, I think it's called. Another Souls-like. It's a shooter, but it is very much like a Souls style game, as there are so many. And a lot of the games that have been inspired by the Souls games have taken pieces of it and moved quite far afield, right? Like they're not even, they're shooters now. Like you can be a game that feels Souls-like, but can be in like a very different genre, right? Yeah. Than you would in something like Elden Ring or Dark Souls or Bloodborne. So it's kind of interesting to see a game come back actually and try to mimic as much as they can and really only push the envelope or tweak things in a few specific avenues, right? Around, you know, the weapon swapping, for example, or the secondary arm element of it. But for the most part, trying to stay true to it. And there's a kind of a fun and interesting thought experiment of like, okay, we've branched out. Let's come back and sort of get back at the heart of what's good again. And now I want to see like this branching out again, right? Like this team who made Lies of P, this is their first game that's anything like this.
Yep.
And if they made, I don't know, Lies of Q, like whatever, the next, like, you know, Pinocchio. I don't know if there's another Pinocchio game in the works, but if they had a follow-up to this that was still Souls-like, I think it would be even better because they were so close to the original, right? Like they really pushed themselves to fit within expectations around that Souls game and the Bloodborne style in particular. If they were to take on the second one, then I think that would then free them up to capture only the best of what makes these games interesting and move on and experiment.
I will not spoil it for you or anyone listening, but I've heard about how this game ends. And I think depending on how well this goes and how funding goes or whatever, they set themselves up to have a different, another shot at something like that.
Oh, really? Okay.
In a hilarious way. Like I laughed out loud when I was listening to someone talk about how this game ended. And I was like, good on you, man. Like just keep going.
I heard the story's pretty good is what I heard.
I mean, it was a story beat. That was the thing that I was just laughing at, you know, the absurdity and kind of the where they want to take it, which I thought was very funny.
Awesome. Well, at this point, I'm committed. I'm going to see Lies of P through to the end for sure.
Nice. I will say really quickly, I'm still playing Sea of Stars and I'm still liking it a lot. It's kind of a spiritual homage to Chrono Trigger with some modern takes on turn-based RPG battling systems. But the one thing I'll say about it, my thoughts remain the same. I think it's a very well designed battle system, and the pixel art is amazing in this game. They do a lot of dynamic lighting, which is something you don't always see in like pixel art. You can control, at some points you can control the sun. So, you know, is it sunset? Is it midday, dusk, all of that? And just the shadows that they do and just how things change from day to night is just so, so good looking. But the thing I'll say about it is, they went full JRPG and they included a game inside the game.
Oh, this is a cocooned. They've been cocooned.
Similar to, you know, Triple Triad or any of those like types of things in the Final Fantasy games. There's a board game inside of Sea of Stars, and I would buy this separately. It's such like an addictive like little kind of, if I could buy it on for my phone, I would probably play it all the time, because it's just this little thing. It's called Wheels.
Marvel Snap.
It's just so, because what they did, similar to Marvel Snap, the you know, the pseudo tactile nature of it is also very satisfying, where you have this board game and it's kind of like this this like mechanical, you know, I don't know what a good...
I'm looking at an image now. It looks like a mechanical slot machine.
It is, yes. So that's
with miniatures.
It's kind of like a cross between it's like an analog, like a pachinko board or like an analog pinball machine. You know, everything kind of like is set up with like little stoppers and wheels and stuff, and basically it's kind of a gambling game. It's kind of a dice game where you roll all five of your wheels, and then you're trying to get like three of a kind, four of a kind, five of a kind of symbols. But you can lock in some of your wheels. So it's like, oh, I got three squares. I want to save those. So I lock those wheels, and then I can spin the rest of the wheels to try to keep getting my matches. Yeah. So like super simple, but there's different systems where it's like, you know, you can get your matches to either increase the XP of your attack characters, or you could use your matches to like spur an attack. You know, you have to get a certain number of matches to even make a move, or you can use your matches to like build up your defenses. And so depending on what you roll, you might be like, oh, well, I was going for XP, but I just got a really lucky roll for defenses, so I'm going to lock those others and, you know, abandon my quest for XP and just try to like do a defensive turn. And it's just so satisfying to like just do those spins and like try to think about what your opponent is going to do three moves ahead. And it seems very complicated at first, but it's actually quite simple. And it's one of those you can just keep kind of, it's like, one more match. Because each match takes, you know, 5 minutes or something like that.
Is there any benefit in the game world of playing this, or is this purely for fun?
It's as far as I can tell, and I haven't gotten every character and every unlock yet, but it's like one of those things where it is kind of like Triple Triad, where you go from town to town and you can fight champions of wheels, and if you beat them you get, you know, extra game boards or extra game pieces, or you can get money if you win. And so there's a little bit of in-game benefit.
There's so many games like this in other games.
Totally. Again, kind of like the
it's like Gwent.
Yes. I mean, I would love if they just did a spin-off of just wheels in the same way that they were going to do that Gwent game, because it's just such a pleasant little quick hit, you know, somewhere 2 and 5 minutes, you know, or maybe more if you're really taking your time. But I've been thinking about Wheels.
We should spin this off into a podcast that's exclusively about video games that you can only play in other video games.
I would love to see a list like that, because there's so many of them, you know, like Blitzball, yeah, all of that crap, you know, like
I'm a Blitzball champ, thank you very much.
Yeah, anyway, so I'm gonna keep playing Sea of Stars, but I mean the other day, like, I was kind of angry at myself, because I was like, man, I just played 30 minutes of Wheels. I could have been progressing in this game.
It's fall 2023. You don't have fucking time to play games within games.
That's why I was saying that. I was like, I'm just playing Wheels in here, where, like, Spider-Man is looming on the horizon and I'm playing Wheels. What am I doing?
Yeah, Mario Game Wonder is coming out in like a day, dude. You gotta move it along.
Anyway, so yeah, it was quite fun. I liked it. I'll keep playing, but I'm gonna keep playing the game too. I think I'm probably, I don't know, maybe halfway through or something like that. So I'll keep chipping away at it.
Good timing. I'm glad that you committed to games that you could reasonably beat, as opposed to me, that's like, you know, 60-hour plus games.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not like I don't have those sitting around. Like Armored Core 6 is gathering dust over there.
Oh yeah, same.
All right, I guess we will leave it there for this week. ExperiencePoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And ExperiencePoints.net is the website. Come on down, bring a friend, share the good news, the good word.
The good word of Wheels.
Of Wheels. You find us wherever you find podcasts. You know, the drill.
All right, until next time, thanks everyone for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Ciao. Every time we